It's one of those images that I am sure will stay with me throughout my life, even though it took place well over 20 years ago. I was delivering a sermon to the congregation I served before coming here in Stony Brook, New York. Their worship space was quite different from ours. They didn't have pews, they had chairs they set up in their room, and the pulpit was on an elevated platform just about that far off the ground and a few feet back from the front row. So I was almost in the front row as I would be speaking. And on this particular Sunday, there was a woman in the front row, right smack dab in front of me practically, who was clutching a Bible about as tightly as an object can be clutched by a human being. I could actually see the whites on her knuckles as I was going along in my sermon. And I was holding forth on a pretty basic UU type of sermon, which included some references, as I recall, to Thomas Jefferson and his deism and his Jefferson Bible, in which he edited out any references that supposedly supported the divinity of Christ. And I tried, as I do on Sundays, I tried to keep my focus and my gaze out at the congregation at large, but I couldn't help but being drawn back to those white knuckles on the Bible as I was going on. Well, the back story here is that the woman's husband had begun attending services some several weeks earlier. And as the coffee hour was winding down during his first or second visit with us, he and I got into a conversation during the coffee hour about some tensions in his marriage that revolved around religious matters. He had not been raised in or exposed to any strong religious faith himself, but he had fairly regularly attended and participated in the life of a rather fundamentalist congregation that his wife was a part of. He was doing this largely to be supportive of her and because he realized and recognized that it was a very important piece of her life. But then he decided to do some religious exploring and questioning of his own, which eventually led him to check out the local UU congregation, where he liked very much what he was seeing and hearing. As you can probably imagine, this created a certain amount of tension on the home front, which may well have been the surface issue for some more deeper troubled currents in their relationship. I think the gentleman brought his wife to the service in question to let her know that he wasn't getting sucked into some weird or mysterious cult. And she and I had a very pleasant coffee hour conversation when the service was over, even as we steered clear of religious matters. Whenever I get into this subject, I think about my father, who maybe not a complete all the way down the line fundamentalist, but about 90 to 95% there, and how his faith sustained him throughout his life. So I don't like to be all that disparaging about it. He's someone I always think about, as I say, when this subject comes up. Well, this all took place, the whole thing I'm mentioning took place just as I was closing out my ministry in Stony Brook before I came here. So I don't know what the eventual outcome of it all was with respect to this gentleman's religious explorations and his and his wife's marriage. In what is now the seventh decade of my life, there's a lot of stuff that's just kind of faded into the mists back there. But the image of that woman's vice-like grip on a Bible as a reaction to a sermon I was delivering has stayed vivid. It's an image that has also helped me to understand the nature, or at least one aspect, not the whole phenomenon, but it's one thing that's helped me to understand at least part of the nature, part of the aspect of fundamentalism, in at least as good a way as all the words that have been written on the subject. For in one sense, this doesn't describe the whole phenomenon, but it's the part I'm focusing on today. It is, among other things, one expression of a very natural and practical universal human phenomenon, which is the impulse to grab on to something solid, or seemingly solid, in the midst of what is perceived as an unsure, or threatening, or maybe unsafe situation. And I got my latest taste of this phenomenon back on Christmas Day, on the last leg of a flight to Charleston, West Virginia, where Michelle and I spent several days with members of my family. As our small twin-engine prop jet approached the Charleston airport, it got caught in some pretty serious crosswinds and did some pretty serious pitching around to the point that I actually felt for a minute that it was going to do a roll. Didn't quite happen, but it felt like that was what it was about to do. And before I even knew what I was doing, I instinctively grabbed a hold of the seat in front of me as the plane's whipping around like this. And I grabbed that seat and I held, I think probably with about the same intensity that the woman I was just telling you about was grabbing a hold of her Bible. And a few minutes later, we were taxiing up to the terminal, and that was that. But I experienced, if only for a few fleeting seconds, that primal human instinct to hold on to something you at least think is solid when it seems like your world is turning upside down. Of course, my grabbing the seat back no more affected the actual operation of the plane than the woman's grabbing the Bible affected the course of, or the historical accuracy as I took it, of my sermon. But in both cases, those kinds of things did not matter. In both cases, each of us were making an instinctual response to a perceived threat to our safety and our well-being. Well, I offer all this as backdrop to the my final reading venture of 2009, which was this book here, the latest one by Dr. Harvey Cox called The Future of Faith. I read it during my just mentioned year-end visit down there to the home country in West Virginia. And I can't quite pin it down, but I find something strangely appropriate about reading a book called The Future of Faith in the days after I momentarily wondered if I was going to be splattered on the side of a West Virginia mountain on Christmas Day, no less. Like much of what Dr. Cox writes, there's a lot of good stuff in here, but I'm not sure I share his contention that religious fundamentalism is a fading phenomenon. I'm going to save that piece for later, however, so I can briefly share with you a bit of my personal journey with Dr. Cox. This gentleman and scholar has been one of my religious, spiritual, and theological mentors and guides for over 40 years. During my junior year in college, I came across his first published book, I believe it was his first published book, called God's Revolution and Man's Responsibility. As quaint and dated and now long out of print as that book is, it shone like the first ray of light into my then fundamentalist mindset, and it let me know there were other ways of being religious than the sin and salvation and biblical literalism brand which I had only known up to that point in my life. You can probably imagine there's a lot bigger story here than I've got time to tell this morning, but Dr. Cox was among those. He wasn't the only one, but he was among those who provided kind of like the first crack in my consciousness that eventually got me into Unitarian Universalism and the UU ministry. And I have read most of what he has written in the ensuing 4.5 decades. His treatment of the nature and workings of religious belief and religion and religious belief in our present age reveals a remarkable degree of depth and insight and historical perspective, which I find far more helpful, actually, than the superficial and dismissive treatment given these matters written by commentators or writers who are simply out to debunk some of the more traditional ideas of God. Well, Harvey himself is not a Unitarian Universalist. He's fine. He's been fine all his life, being in the liberal Protestant Christian camp. His wife is Jewish. He does show up at our UU General Assemblies now and then, though. Sometimes when he's got a book out or when he's asked to do a presentation of some kind, he's very UU friendly. The first time I ever met him, in fact, was at one of our UU General Assemblies. And we were able to get into a little conversation, and I told him that depending upon who you ask, he either put me on the road to religious enlightenment or ruin me for life and put me on the road to hell. He got a pretty good laugh out of that. In fact, the man is certainly not without a sense of humor. I don't know how many of you read the Boston Globe or how many of you may have caught this back last fall, but he got a feature article in the Globe, I think it was back in September, when he pastured a cow in Harvard Yard. The occasion was his retirement at the age of 80, no less, as the Hollis Professor of Divinity at Harvard University. He did a little research on this chair that he held and discovered that when the chair was established, clear back in 1721, one of the perks that went with the job was that you were allowed to pasture your cow, or let your cow graze at Harvard Yard. So he figured that he would take advantage of this perk before relinquishing the position. Honest to God. And, so he went out, he got himself a cow, which he named Faith, and led her around the yard while dressed in full academic regalia. Dr. Cox was in the academic regalia, by the way, not the town. Which would have been a pretty interesting sight by itself. Well, to cut to his latest book, finally, which I can only treat in very broad strokes, he draws a very interesting distinction in here between faith and belief. Dr. Cox likes faith quite a bit, likes it enough, in fact, to name a cow after it, but belief, well, not so much. Faith, as he uses the term in the book, is about how we order and live our lives in the face of the wonder and the mystery and the awe, and yes, even the anxiety we feel as we look out upon our universe and wonder about what our place in it is and what it all means to be a part of it. I'll use some of his words on this matter. Faith starts with awe. It begins with a mixture of wonder and fear all human beings feel toward the mystery that envelops us. But awe becomes faith only as it ascribes some meaning to that mystery. Since we are creatures who use language and symbols that vary from age to age and culture to culture, the meanings we ascribe will inevitably differ. All religions and cultures are responses to the same fundamental mystery, but each perceives and responds in its own way. Close quote. A life of faith, then, as he is defining it here, is one that attempts to find meaning in the midst of mystery. And we all do that. Belief, then, as Cox again defines it in his book, occurs when this dynamic faith process becomes codified into a set of stated tenets that supposedly explain the meaning of the mystery. And explains the meaning of the mystery to those who will then subscribe to those tenets of belief. Now, it's practically inevitable that a journey of meaning of any kind will at some point lead to certain kinds of conclusions and certain kinds of affirmations. We all do that, consciously or not. The problem occurs when the affirmations that come about in this faithing process, if you will, become elevated to fixed and supposedly eternal and inflexible truths. And the example that Cox uses for all this, one of the early chapters in the book, is one that was pretty familiar to those of us who took part in that From Jesus to Christ seminar that we did here back last fall over in the chapel. Dr. Cox points out, as those of us in that course also saw, that the first 300 years of what came to be called Christianity largely consisted of communities of persons, mostly in and around the Western Mediterranean, who were attempting to be faithful to the teachings and the example of Jesus. That is to say, they saw in Jesus' life and teachings a meaningful way of living within this larger mystery that envelops and enfolds us all. Indeed, these people were originally called followers of the way. The term Christianity didn't come along until later. Now, their beliefs as to who Jesus was and what he was about were quite varied and quite diverse, as various archaeological discoveries over the past 50 to 60 years have demonstrated, particularly the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Nag Hammadi texts. And these beliefs that they held, again, as we saw in that From Jesus to Christ course, these beliefs generated a great deal of contention at times during those first 300 years of Christianity. But those early Christians, with all their differing beliefs, still lived a more or less common faith in the sense of trying to be faithful to what Jesus did and taught. It wasn't until, a little after the year 300, it wasn't until the Emperor Constantine made Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire that it moved from being an evolving and changing and rather open-ended faith to a specifically codified set of beliefs as enumerated in the Nicene Creed and enforced by what became a centralized church structure in Rome. This, in turn, made Christianity a religion of who was in and who was out, who supposedly had the correct beliefs and who didn't, and in some very tragic and horrible instances, who could be tried for heresy and burned at the stake, and who could be spared. Well, Cox calls this whole process, the move from what I just described, He calls that whole process the move from the age of faith to the age of belief. And then he goes on to claim that we're in the midst of yet another shift. This time he says we are shifting from the age of belief to the age of the Spirit. And that, in fact, is the subtitle of this book, The Rise and Fall of Belief and the Coming Age of the Spirit. And a good deal of the book then is given over to what Dr. Cox offers as examples from around the world of this shift from what he calls age of belief to age of spirit. Well, I'm going to save that part of my sermon for 2 weeks from now for a sermon I've entitled Spiritual But Not Religious. That also happens to be the title of a conference I'll be attending in the week that follows. And Dr. Cox makes reference to this recurring expression, which he sees gaining more and more currency. He sees this line or this sentiment that I am spiritual but not religious. He points to that as one of the many indicators of this shift to which he speaks. As I say, I'm going to hold my take on that one for a couple of weeks, for I want to look at how Dr. Cox deals with fundamentalism in the light of his thesis. In a nutshell, he believes that fundamentalism will fade as the age of the Spirit, as the age of belief gives way to the age of the Spirit. He draws another one of those distinctions, where he says evangelicalism is still going to thrive because it is focused more so on what evangelicals call the receiving of the Holy Spirit in their hearts. That's where evangelicalism focuses more than it does on biblical literalism. Now, evangelicals are conservative, Bible-centered Christians. There's no question about that. But their emphasis is more upon feeling God in their hearts than it is being focused on a codified set of beliefs up in their heads. Now, fundamentalists and evangelicals will overlap at times, but they're not quite the same. And megachurches like those led by Rick Warren or Joel Osteen are much more evangelical-oriented than they are fundamentalists, and they show very little signs of fading at all, and Dr. Cox recognizes that. But even with that kind of distinction, which is a balance, I'm still not quite ready to accept, maybe as much as I would like to, Dr. Cox's contention that fundamentalism, but perhaps not evangelicalism, is a fading phenomenon. And all I need to do to come to that conclusion is look at the origins of Christian fundamentalism in America, which Dr. Cox himself describes in his book, and that gets me at my reservations. For far from being an old-time religion, American Christian fundamentalism really took shape in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And it was a reaction to modernism. And it was triggered, by and large, by three things, or three that I'll point out. One was Darwinism and the theory of evolution, which challenged the notion that human beings were specifically and purposefully created by a divine being at a specific point in time and for a divine purpose. The second was Freudian psychology, not the specific so much, which have been challenged from all sides, but the whole notion that our personalities and our actions are influenced by drives and defenses and needs that have a sexual component, that was an affront and a challenge to traditional morality. And the third was an evolving field of biblical studies and criticism, which demonstrated that the Bible, while still a work of great worth and value and worthy of study, was also a human document created over a large span of human history and in response to particular human happenings. And that challenged the whole idea of its being a unified text which was uniformly and divinely inspired. Well, all of that was plenty enough to send the plane into a barrel roll, and a cadre of conservative Christians grabbed the back of the seat by putting forth what they called the five fundamentals that one had to believe in order to be a true Christian. True Christian, that is, in the face of all of these alleged assaults that were being made on the faith. It was also their way of doing battle with those more moderate to liberal Christians who were and still are finding ways of accommodating and adjusting their faith to the currents of the modern age. In fact, it was and still is actually the moderate to liberal Christians who were and are as much the target of fundamentalists as are the out-and-out atheists and agnostics who are kind of decided to be beyond the pale anyway. And just for the record, just to get them out here real quick, the five fundamentals are, number one, the verbal inerrancy of the Bible, every word of it is true. Second, the virgin birth of Jesus, Third, substitutionary atonement, meaning that Jesus' death was to redeem you from your sins. The fourth is the bodily resurrection of Jesus, and the fifth is the second coming of Christ in all his glory. Now, the first one, the verbal inerrancy of the Bible, is kind of like the cornerstone, the foundation of all the rest of them. I'm not going to go into any of that now, other than to note that the verbal inerrancy of the Bible is something that just does not work, and once that goes, all the other four go with it. The larger point, however, is that fundamentalism, whatever its specific content, and whatever particular religion or religious text it may be based upon, is in part at least an attempt to grab a hold of something that is at least felt to be solid whenever the fundamentals of one's world and the foundations of one's world are being undermined or thrown into a tailspin. And this is why, with all the respect and admiration and indebtedness I feel towards Dr. Cox, I can't quite go with him on the idea that fundamentalism will fade as the age of belief gives way to the age of the Spirit. I do happen to believe that his larger picture is on target. For if I take the view from 30,000 feet here, I really seem to be big on airplane metaphors this morning. But if I take the view from 30,000 feet, a lot of what he says is indeed taking place. I think this ship is accurate in a lot of ways. It's just that on the ground, there's still going to be some serious rearguard action, since any move from specific beliefs to a more generated kind of faith of the Spirit, so to speak, is going to generate the very same kind of fears and anxieties and uncertainties for which fundamentalism provides a ready response. I'll just offer one example because I know I need to wrap this up. I'm really beginning to think that this whole issue of same-sex marriage is going to become the 21st century version of those three things I cited earlier that gave rise to the five fundamentals. For even though it has no actual or practical effect at all upon the overall institution of marriage itself, as far as I can see, on some deeper instinctual level, though, in the minds of many folks, same-sex marriage is an indication that the plane's about to do a barrel roll and that the foundations of our culture are somehow being undermined. And however irrational all that may be, and as far as I'm concerned, it is, it doesn't matter. A perceived threat, rational or not, is going to generate a reactive response. All we got to do is look at history for this. There were vicious and at times deadly responses to the full enfranchisement of African Americans in this country, and that took place in my own lifetime. There were heated responses to the enfranchisement of women, much of them religiously based. And we even fought a civil war, in part, not entirely, but in part over the matter of whether or not there should be human slavery in this country. Any threat to any alleged way things are supposed to be is going to generate a reaction. And fundamentalism of one kind or another, religious and or political, will be a part of that reaction. So, Harvey Cox, I love you, man. But it ain't going to go away. Two quick things in closing now. As to how what I've offered this morning I feel is germane to us, germane and challenging to us as liberal religious persons of a UU persuasion. First, I think we need to remain as committed as ever to our very broad-based, as I see it, open-ended, in the good sense, open-ended principle of affirming the inherent worth and dignity of every person, and of justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. History teaches us as well that every move to advance these goals by persons of a wide variety of faith stances and personal convictions, whether religiously based or not, every move to advance these goals over the course of history has drawn a counterpunch. For all the advances we may make, we're never fully home free. And the second point or challenge, to which I'll return in 2 weeks, has to do with how we, as a liberal religious community, respond to what I do believe, given even some of my reservations, is a coming age of the Spirit. How do we respond to those who say they are spiritual but not religious? And what does that phrase even mean? Simply debunking outworn beliefs offers little, if anything, to persons seeking greater spiritual depth and maturity in their lives. To play on a metaphor coined by Jesus, I don't think you'll find it, we need to offer the bread of affirmation and not a stone of conviction. And I happen to think we do it pretty well on the spiritual affirmation. And I think we can always do more. I'm going to save the rest of my thoughts on this for the 24th, following our observation of Dr. King's birthday next Sunday. So perhaps there is an age of the Spirit going, as Dr. Cox predicts. In some ways, however, that working of the Spirit has been an ongoing thing for many ages. And that's what our closing hymn is about. It's called It Sounds Along, Ages. It's number 187. Let's sing that together.